This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Hello, good afternoon. My name's Christy Anthony. I'm currently the Creative Director of the Adelaide College of the Arts, the TAFE building, and previously at the Adelaide Fringe. I'd like to welcome you here today as your chair and acknowledge that today we are gathered on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains and that we recognise and respect their cultural heritage, beliefs and relationship with the land. We acknowledge that they are of continuing importance to the Kaurna people living today, and we respect their elders past and present. I would like to also give you a little bit of housekeeping before we start, please. That is to switch your mobile phone to silent. This is the new off, so that you may tweet during the presentation if you so wish. And tweet at tag is at Idea Adelaide, Ideas Adelaide, that's IDEASADELAIDE. And our hashtag is #AFOI, Adelaide Festival of Ideas. So feel free to tweet as you wish. It's a pleasure for me to be introducing today's speaker, and I have to tell you, there has been a slight change to the program. David Sefton is not in Adelaide. He arrives in Adelaide, however, to live very soon. So there will be many, many more opportunities for those of you from Adelaide to hear his tales. But what this does do is give us, give Faith Liddell the time she deserves to really tell you the stories of Edinburgh and Dundee and allow us to have a conversation afterwards. Faith Liddell is the director, producer and project manager in theatre, literature, music and visual arts. Faith specialises in the creation and development of festivals and festival-based programs. She's currently the director of Festivals Edinburgh, which focuses on the joint strategic direction of all 12 festivals in Edinburgh. And other assignments include project management of the National Short Story Campaign and producer for the National Theatre of Scotland. In the past, Faith has been director of the DCA, the Dundee Contemporary Art, Scotland's leading centre for contemporary art and film, the project manager for the Scottish Playwrights Studio Development Project, director of the Edinburgh International Book Festival, and marketing manager for the Edinburgh Fringe. She's also the visiting professor at the Edinburgh and Napier University. Faith and I have personally known each other for over 20 years, as I got my backpack and headed off to Edinburgh and our worlds collided then. She is a wonderful godmother to my daughter Edie in Adelaide and therefore very familiar with this city as well, which will enlighten her conversation with us. Faith's spirit is vast and her influence enormous, and her commitment to creating a better, more integrated world is absolutely unswervable. She's, in my opinion, a real international treasure, and I hope you'll make her welcome now, please.
Thank you, Christy. You're making me blush. Good afternoon, everyone. It's a very great pleasure to be at the Festival of Ideas and to be back here in Adelaide. And indeed, I hope with Christy's help and with your contributions that this event will be a tale not just of two cities, but of three. And an exploration of great cultural phenomena, the roles they fall into, that they forge, that they force sometimes, and that they sometimes have foisted on them in relation to the cities that they inhabit. And the stories also that we all need to tell, we need to learn to articulate and share about them. The story of Adelaide's festivals is a compelling one as well, and with the now annual festival kicking off next year, I think it's going to be a very interesting time. But first, let's trace back the thousands of miles, the journey I've just taken back to Scotland. And of course, the tales I'm going to tell you are personal ones as well. They're my own stories and interpretations, as well as those of cultural and civic enterprise. So my relationship with Edinburgh and its festivals is a very long one. I lived in a small town just outside Edinburgh, about 10 miles out. But Edinburgh wasn't really a regular haunt for me, except for kind of big item shopping and, of course, the festivals in August. My parents started to take me to Edinburgh's festivals from very early on, beginning with kind of children's shows, and then they were teachers to the core through a highly constructed educational curve to more ambitious experiences. I remember the excitement appointment of some of the great productions in Satire of the Three Estates playing as part of Edinburgh International Festival in the Assembly Hall of the Church of Scotland. And I also remember guiltily scurrying past the statue of John Knox, the father of Presbyterianism, that stood in the entrance to get in. And I also remember my first deliciously confused taste of nakedness on stage as my dad accidentally took my sister and I, who were 11 and 10 at the time, to an erotic reinterpretation of Herman Melville's Moby Dick. Chronically embarrassed about sitting next to my father, I actually didn't dare move my head during the whole of the production, and of course so missed most of the flesh and all of the action. More later of Edinburgh Festival's role in loosening up the narrow bindings of our Calvinist inheritance. By 15, I was saving my pocket money and creating my own Edinburgh Festival fringe and festival and fringe experience. I had a menu of thousands of things to choose from. And I understood even then that I had access to something absolutely remarkable. But my real love affair with Edinburgh began when I went to live there to do my postgrad. And I clearly again remember sitting at the top of the mound on a bench, my first day living in the city of the Enlightenment, the medieval town behind me, the new town before me, the castle to my left, the classic columns of the National Galleries below me, the monument to Sir Walter Scott right in front of me, the Writers Museum that featured him and Robert Louis Stevenson and Robert Burns behind me again. And I felt utterly and irretrievably in love with its beauty and with its sense of history, the sense of history that infused it. I didn't really know or care very much about the humans who inhabited it in the present, although I have to say I do now a great deal. And I've gone on to live and work in Edinburgh in all the capacities that Christy has described, producing a fringe venue, running a festival, running a venue, and then running the organisation Festivals Edinburgh that I do now. And that beauty and history still absolutely resonate with me and many of my fellow residents and the millions of visitors. But these inherited givens, including its festivals, are not enough, as Edinburgh is slowly learning. The genesis of my relationship with Dundee was a very different one, with absolutely no givens. To give you an idea of what Dundee was like in the 80s when I first encountered it, I need to quote the 2004 quarterly essay by your fellow countryman, David Malouf, in his examination of the relationship between Australia and the so-called mother country, Great Britain. He tried to define and describe the enormous changes that had taken place in Australian culture and society over the last 50 years. He did so by describing a visit north to Dundee when he was over in Edinburgh at the Book Festival. And he conjured up a kind of the social and spiritual desolation, the stark emptiness of the streets in the morning, the absence of people, the bleak architecture. Dundee, he said, was like Australia in the 50s. And I got the impression that that was quite bad. That was his story, and that's the state I first encountered Dundee in. I found it grim, closed off, depressed, as he said, architecturally and socially impoverished. The friends who I went to see, who lived there, were working for Dundee Repertory Theatre, and they were passionate about the people and the work that they were doing to connect audiences with their work and build an ambitious and empowering theatre in education and community programme. But there was no denying that the erosion of Dundee's industrial past and the loss of its proud manufacturing history had crippled its confidence. What was left of these traditions and an amazing medieval street pattern had literally been concreted over. I just remember it always being dark. When I returned there in 2002 to become the director of Dundee Contemporary Arts, the new leading centre for contemporary art and film in Scotland, Dundee was in the fragile early stages of a renaissance. I'd moved there to a house that looked over the river, the Tay River, to my building. It was the first cultural building in my care, and I just wanted to make sure that I could see it if it went on fire. I drove over the bridge on my first day, and I stopped at the toll station. There was a toll on the bridge then. I said, "Hello, how are you?" As the man took my money. He looked at me with a kind of grim intolerance and didn't say a single word. Now, I can be a curmudgeonly, self-tormenting Presbyterian too, but even at my worst, I can manage a monosyllable. "Oh," I thought. I'd just come from running the largest book festival in the world. I'd had an audience of 200,000 at that event. That was more than the whole population of Dundee. I'd managed to move and shift their perceptions and tastes and habits. Oh, I thought, I'm going to do something about that. I'm going to make him talk. I'm going to make him smile. I parked my car and I walked into my new building. It was light, bold, contemporary, interconnected. It was full of people and hope. In the cafe bar, I stopped dead. I thought I spotted one of Scotland's leading poets, one of the world's leading poets sitting at a table. I did a double take. It was Don Paterson. I looked again. He was sitting beside Kathleen Jamie. I waved at them both as they returned their restrained Dundonian smiles and then did a triple and a quadruple take. There was John Burnside, Douglas Dunn, and yes, Robert Crawford too, in my building, five of Scotland's greatest poets. And they were shyly proprietorial about the space that was going to be in my care. Not a literary space as yet, although we brought literature in, but a home and a landing point for creatives in the city and the surrounds. It belonged to them, and I, at that moment, felt I began to belong as well. I'd had my struggles at Edinburgh International Book Festival in getting the recognition and funding within the City of Edinburgh Council to support the ambitions that I felt were necessary for it to evolve and to continue to position itself as the international leader in its field. I'd got some way after some time with some enlightened colleagues in the City Council, but felt that Edinburgh was very much sitting on its aesthetic and historical laurels. And Dundee, well, despite the ambitions that Dundee DCA and Dundee Contemporary Arts represented, it seemed to me that Dundee was still wearing a crown of thorns, that it was a martyred city, still too fondly bound to the narratives of negativity. I basically wanted to swap the vegetation around. I wanted to softly swathe Dundee, the self-deprecating Dundee, in laurels, and I wanted to stick some thorns under Edinburgh's smug arse. Maybe I still do. But let me get on with my stories. And first, the story of the creation of Dundee Contemporary Arts and what became known as the DCA effect. Once upon a time, in the early 1990s, in a struggling, uncertain, and rather despised post-industrial city perched on the edge of the North Sea in a half-formed country on the edge of Europe, the beginnings of a dream were being teased out by politicians and city council officials. The vision was for a centre for the visual arts, driven not by the artistic imperative, though it defined a gap in provision in the city, but by a sense of the potential economic benefits such a space would bring to the city. You heard what David Malouf said about Dundee. My fellow countrymen were sometimes less polite. Again, to use that rude word, they said that they basically called it the arse end of Scotland. Both these interpretations are grossly unfair. Dundee's a city with spirit and character, with a potent dry humour and a proud history of radicalism and of women's rights. But there were some grim certainties. It was a city with massive urban deprivation. 95% of the children in the Whitfield area of the city, for example, were living in poverty. The city had the highest rate of teenage pregnancy in the whole of Europe. Individual and civic confidence were pretty low. The original idea for Dundee was a relatively modest and appropriately modest Dundee enterprise involving some new gallery space, and it also had to amalgamate some resistant printmaking facilities. And the nature of the visual arts that were going to sit at the centre of this offer were really undefined at this stage. When it opened 5 years later in 1999, Dundee Contemporary Arts told a very different story. It was the largest single Scottish Arts Council Capital Lottery funded project in Scotland. It was the result of a unique partnership between the City of Dundee, the University of Dundee and DCA Limited, the charitable company that was set up to run it. It was an award-winning landmark building with a bold vision for programming that would allow it to compete internationally while connecting with the minds, the hearts and the aspirations of the community that was its home. In addition to two world-class gallery spaces, the production facilities for artists and the education space, in the intervening years, Dundee had acquired two art house cinema spaces, a shop and a craft space, the Visual Arts Centre for the University of Dundee, and a large cafe bar facility. It had accidentally almost become a combination of facilities that was unique in Europe in a building that reflected these creative connections and encouraged movement between them. The story of how that happened was really about leadership and luck and a certain kind of infectious boldness. And it's therefore, as always, a story of individuals at a particular time. There was, as Malcolm Gladwell describes it, a tipping point involving some remarkable and remarkably determined people who communicated a vision, persuaded partners and funders, and beautifully bludgeoned their way through political and cultural barriers. They did what one classic model of leadership does. They created a vision, they communicated it or told their story, and they aligned the resources to make it happen. Those people included the head of arts and leisure at the City Council, the head of visual arts at the Scottish Arts Council, who was to become DCA's first director, no self-interest involved in getting it all set up on his part, and a key local politician and one of the people within economic development. But leadership and vision also came importantly, and I think it's interesting in a city like Adelaide, from the universities. In terms of international leadership and international scale and connections, that's where that came from. And their sense of international connection added that element to the whole concept, and it continues to do so even now. The Labour Party had a strong hold of power at the City Council. Lottery funding for capital development was plentiful. The other facilities and the part-time cinema were in need of reinvigoration. And at that stage, in the whole of Scotland, there was no outstanding space for contemporary art, despite Scottish artists really being incredibly prominent in the international field. Interestingly, by the time I got there, that was just 3 years after it was established, that DCA couldn't have happened. Although it was in itself a tipping point for the whole city, as you'll hear, in my first year in post, the single biggest success story that Dundee had had in 30 years saw its funding cut. Just as a kind of political sop, you know, to a planning decision where the Conservative vote was needed, but they insisted on the grant being reduced. So, you know, the makeup of the City Council had changed and we were immediately vulnerable. Our own leadership wasn't enough. We needed, as indeed we all need, and I continue to need in the role that I have now, kind of shared vision and aspirations deeply rooted across the political divides with key individuals at that kind of level, at the political and the funding level. And also, we need evidence that what we do matters in a broad cultural and in a social context as well. And, as I've said before, the eloquence to communicate the intrinsic values and to tell our story. We need to keep telling our story and keep finding the right way of doing so. So 10 years on from its creation, DCA has indeed proved to be transformational in an ongoing way. Companionship, particularly from the city's head of leisure and City Council's head of leisure, has been essential to that. And to a kind of continuing ambition, which to kind of illustrate why, is that the V&A is now creating its first space outside London in its entire existence in Dundee. And that's an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing that it's happening at all. And it's an amazing thing that a city like Dundee is going to be the home for that initiative. And again, of course, it's an astonishing shift again in the pride and confidence of the city, but still always a vulnerable one, as my experience showed. DCA has been consistently and sometimes dangerously bold in its programming and approach. It's propelled itself to the front ranks of contemporary art presentation in the UK and internationally. It's recognised as a leader in its field in Scotland, and it's literally been credited with changing the face of Scottish art both and its perception both at home and abroad. There's an exhibition called Here and Now, Scottish Art 1990 to 2001, that was absolutely crucial in this area. And though I'm biased, I know I'm biased, I'm going to quote one of our leading art critics in Scotland's major Sunday broadsheet, who said, "Two major events changed the Scottish art world forever. The first was the opening in 1999 of Dundee Contemporary Arts. The second, their hugely successful exhibition Here and Now. The importance of these two phenomena in bringing new Scottish art to a wider audience cannot be overstated. They simply made it, and in the case of Dundee, continue to make it accessible. They broke down perceived barriers. More importantly, they told us not to be afraid. Art, they declared, was more about money, mediocrity, and the monarch of the Glen. It was about love, sex, identity, obsession, even sport. In short, the everyday delights and disasters of being alive, the consequences of this small revolution have had a lasting effect." And the DCA has continued its role in defining the profile and position of Scotland's artists, leading on the creation of the Scottish Pavilion in Venice on their 10th anniversary last year. The print studio has 200 members. The cultural cinema, cinema quadrupled cultural cinema audiences in the city, and the community and education programme has affected literally tens of thousands of people every year who engage and explore this quite bold and sometimes difficult work. And they really also have an outlet in combination with that for their own creative endeavours as well, which are displayed there. It's also created major new events. I mean, one of the things that I particularly worked on was bringing in new festivals, new that connected to the work that already existed there, but also had their own clear identities. So we brought in an animation festival, which connected to the industry in the city, an experimental music and moving image festival, and Scotland's first international film festival for children and young people. New ideas and art forms were drawn into those that inhabited the building or grew out from the creative cohesions in the city, so strengths, bottom-up strengths that existed in the city. Over 300,000 people came through DCA's doors each year. That's more than the Scottish National Gallery of Modern Art. And there are queues outside the door every Friday and Saturday night. It's commonly referred to as the only art centre in the UK that has to have bouncers. But it's also the place for anyone in the creative or scientific world of the city, which houses a huge cancer and welcome trust centres, to meet and greet and eat and entertain. And it's allowed them to meet across their disciplines in ways that simply don't happen anywhere else. It's become a meeting place for science and industry as well as art. And people owned it and loved it in their peculiar way. We ran a survey where we were looking at people who weren't attending, and 85% of even those who weren't attending, who'd never set foot in the building, said they were really proud of it. But we also had a very engaged and critical audience. I remember being interrupted as I was giving a tour of an exhibition by a group of international curators, by an old local man who told me and them in no uncertain terms that the Japanese sculpture, whose contemporary delicacy I'd just been waxing lyrical about, was a pile of pish, which is Scottish for not very good at all. And of course, they sometimes love things that they don't even know are part of an arts enterprise. I used to hijack our toilets and cover them in poetry curated by the aforementioned Don Patterson, so that at least DCA drinkers would have to be forced to engage with some kind of art. I also saw it, obviously, as a triumph when they were stolen. It's through the combination of interconnecting creative outputs and DCA's committed relationship with artists and audiences that the enterprise has been so hugely successful. But it's also through boldness and a kind of constant consciousness of the social, cultural, educational and economic ecology of the city that it lives in. And it's transformed not only a city's sense of itself, but as importantly, how it is perceived by the rest of Scotland and internationally. And it's through the role that it's embraced as a social and a cultural meeting place, as well as a home for art. Let's get down to it. It's also through takings at the bar, the dizzy attraction of drink, cool architecture, and proximity to culture. An independent economic impact evaluation established that DC had done this in an unprecedented way, as well as creating 260 jobs for the local economy, generating a whole series of businesses that have created a new cultural and creative quarter, and literally transforming the way the people in the city interacted socially. You heard the David Malouf story. There was nobody out there in the streets. So it had changed all of that as well. Now, I commissioned that impact study partly because I was becoming nervous of the hype of the narrative that we and my colleagues were, purveying. As a sort of instinctive gusher, it's a kind of enduring nervousness for me in any enterprise. But we found that our instincts were actually right, that the DCA effect, as it became known, was a real thing. In fact, the independent economist that we employed gave me a serious ticking off when we were briefing him, gushing at him, about how amazing DCA's impacts were. He insisted, you know, in his Dundonian, slightly humorless way in this case, an independent analyst, he was a scientist, you know, he needed proof, not my rhetoric. But rather amusingly, by the time he was doing his report, it was actually me telling him to settle down, because what he told us was that the creation of Dundee had literally transformed the perceptions, attractiveness and confidence of the city. I also commissioned the study because I needed ammunition and substance for our story. I needed empirical evidence of DCA's importance to make sure our funding was never, ever cut again, or that I could kick up a huge fuss with some serious hard-hitting facts if it was. And while the economic impacts were the focus for this document, the artistic impacts were as importantly. After all, as we proved later on in Edinburgh with the research we've just done there, when it comes down to economic and social impacts, they only exist as a result of the creative ones. So the partnerships that brought DC into being and the many subsequent partnerships it's led or engaged with are essential to the artistic drive of the aspirational curves in the city that take people from schools to colleges to universities and ultimately into the workplaces in the city, in a city now dominated by the creative industries and the biotech industries. It's still an area of multiple social deprivation, and those curves are absolutely essential to any hope of the city retaining its population, and indeed to the hopes of that population itself. It's a remarkable story, and DCA's boldness continues to evolve. Its ambition now is quite simply to run the cultural life of the city, and in the same way that the old industrial models used to run the economic life of the town. It wants to explore with its partners in the city what the role, and I think this is interesting for us, it may be interesting for you in due course, what the role of a cultural organisation is in a non-growth economy. Because I think that's a very interesting idea. It wants to operate at the root of people's lives in the city. And the idea of the aspirational curve, it's a very big curve in this case. So it's a 20-year strategy that will ensure that every child who exits primary school in Dundee has an appetite for culture that's fed by the resources of DCA. But defining how that story of the future is told continues to be essential to the sense of common purpose and aspiration that it needs to share with its city. And Dundee needs to keep telling its own remarkable story to itself with consistency and with conviction in order to cast off that crown of thorns for good and define a new narrative that reflects the best of the possibilities DCA has helped to evolve. And just so you know, the man at the toll booth and I got on first name terms. So what about Edinburgh? What's the story there? Well, Edinburgh is just special, isn't it? You know, it hardly needs to try. Despite being a resident on and off for 20 years, I'm still literally stopped in my tracks by the beauty of the city. Just as I walk to a meeting or just step out of my front door, I am still in love. But beyond the dramatic contours of Scotland's capital, beyond its historic buildings and streets and its innovative new architecture, beyond its awe-inspiring landscapes, and they are wonderful, beyond all the spectacular sort of permanence of all of that, our city plays host to something very amazing, really, and wonderfully impermanent by nature, because Edinburgh has its festivals. And as the heat of mainland Europe sets in the summer, we, in what we like to call the expansive freshness of the Scottish summer, welcome the world into our heady and seductive embrace. As this very small capital, we're under 500,000 people, is transformed literally into the cultural capital of the world. And now you in the city know the transforming power that a really great festival can bring to a city. I think it's almost impossible, and it'll be interesting to see how many people have been to Edinburgh, for anyone who's not experienced to understand the intensity of that magic when you have not one but seven festivals happening over 5 weeks. And you actually have three, but seven takes a scale up a bit further. We know you're trying to catch up with us. From late July to early September every year, our city is profoundly inhabited by art and ideas and entertainment on an unrivaled and intoxicating scale. It becomes a source of inspiration for over 20,000 artists and producers, and for literally hundreds of thousands of visitors from across the globe. It's an astonishing place to live and to work year-round, and there are 12 festivals to enjoy for artists and audiences, and opportunities to engage with a whole creative world of experience. As I said, there's actually over 25,000 artists in Edinburgh every year. 2,000 accredited media are in the city during that peak period. 1,000 festival directors and producers and theatre directors buying work, and 4.2 million attendances. We are collectively, undeniably, the greatest arts phenomenon on the globe. And if Edinburgh's festivals create the platform for the best and most important of international arts, and these are ideas, they're incredibly important also as an international platform for Scotland and for work from Scotland. And for audience, this mix is part and parcel of the unique appeal of the festival. What happens in Edinburgh couldn't happen anywhere else. And our festivals literally and distinctively inhabit every corner of the historic heart of our city, every church hall, every theatre, every courtyard, every basement, every park, from the Castle Esplanade, this amazing setting for our Edinburgh military tattoo, to the dark, narrow, cobbled closes of the High Street, from the grandeur of our big festival theatre to the dark intimacy of the city's underground passages, which have also been inhabited by work. What Edinburgh becomes in August is kind of this incredibly dense, I mean, unbelievably dense cultural habitat. And our audiences are its indomitable explorers. But that density, that kind of year-round wealth of choice, is created through very, very individual, clearly defined festivals and their visions, their unique programme, and the ambitions and visions of their directors. So far... So very certain. But what are the roots of the international, of the festival city that Edinburgh has become? Well, they just were not so certain at all. And just with Dundee, we're dependent on luck and leadership and infectious boldness. So let's begin at the beginning with the Edinburgh International Festival. It's 1947, and many of the countries and cities of Europe and the world are still reeling and feeling the pain and devastation of World War II, and an almost kind of chronic uncertainty about what the future would hold. The luck was that Edinburgh, unlike most other cities in Europe, was virtually undamaged by bombing. The leadership came from across civic society at the time, the city council and its mayor, or our Lord Provost, as we call him. The great and the good in the form of Lord Rosebery, though his luck on the horses is also said to have contributed to the initial financial structures of the festival, and Rudolf Bing of Glenburgh Opera, who was the first director of the International Festival. And then, of course, internationalism again. The British Council were founding members. Internationalism was right at the heart of this birth too. And the vision really was amazing, one that continues to resonate with us, all of our festivals now, because the Edinburgh International Festival was founded in the post-war belief that this festival should enliven and enrich the cultural life of Europe, Britain, Scotland and the world, and bring the countries of the world together through culture, providing a platform for what they called a reflowering of the human spirit. Some of the world's finest artists and companies were invited to perform at the city's theatres in the first year, including, again, remarkably in that year, a German and an Austrian orchestra, just so fast on the heels of the Second World War, and one of them conducted by a Jewish conductor. The founders had high hopes for the cultural, but interestingly, right from the start, also for the social and tourism benefits that such a festival might bring. It was a pioneering plan. It was the first festival of its kind in the world. And again, 60 years on, it's still vision-driven in terms of artistic programming, but interventionist in a way in terms of its potential instrumental benefits for tourism. In the same year, another kind of boldness began its international story when 8 theatre companies turned up uninvited to perform in Edinburgh at the newly formed festival. They were unhappy about not being included in the programme, and the actors and directors, originally called festival adjuncts, it doesn't sound very sexy, realised there would be audiences in the city and that there would be media in the city, and they staged their shows on the periphery of the main event, starting to occupy alternative spaces. One Scottish critic described them as being on the fringes of the festival, and so the Edinburgh Festival Fringe was born. It's now officially the largest and still non-programmed arts festival in the world, and the Fringe still operates under its core funding principle that anyone with a story to tell and a venue that is able to host them can take part. By 2011, there were over 40,000 performances, over 3,000 shows in 259 different venues, with over 1.7 million tickets sold. And of course, our festival Fringe has spawned fringe festivals all over the world, including yours. 1947 was also the year that saw the birth of the Edinburgh International Film Festival. It was another first in the city, and it pioneered a showcase of the new and flourishing documentary movement in the day. But it was a kind of rebellious movement as well. It was like, film isn't included in this festival either. We're going to come along. And then the last of our early starters in 1950, that decade opened with the first Royal Edinburgh Military Tattoo, which, as I said, is staged in the glorious setting of Edinburgh Castle. This is now a kind of globally, it's a global event. It's our biggest international brand. It's about Scottish music and military culture. And again, it performs to over 200,000 people, but it's also broadcast to 300 million people worldwide. And then our summer portfolio began to be enhanced over the years. We have a Jazz and Blues Festival, which is Britain's oldest and biggest jazz festival, the Edinburgh International Book Festival, the largest celebration of the written word in the world, with 700 events over 17 days. The Mela, which is our multicultural festival in the 80s as well. And then our newest edition, the Edinburgh Art Festival. And of course, Edinburgh, I mean, I've talked principally about that kind of conflagration in the summer, but Edinburgh doesn't take a bow at the beginning of September and leave the festival stage. We have our Edinburgh International Science Festival, which is Europe's largest public celebration of science and technology, a first of its kind in the world as well, a children's festival of theatre, an international storytelling festival, and as the year draws to the close, we celebrate our new year in style with Edinburgh's Hogmanay, again, a massive tourism product as well as a cultural product as well. So we have over 80,000 people partying from all over the world, but also some fabulous ritual cultural events as well. Cultural and political commentator Joyce McMillan, who's written extensively about Scotland, Edinburgh and its festivals, credits Edinburgh's festivals with the transformation of the city from a repressed, inward-looking, Presbyterian provincial city with a decaying heart to international capital, tourism magnet, home to our new parliament and source of a nascent new sense of confident national identity. So, a range of events you think any city would be proud to support and promote and exploit. And in many ways, the organic growth, because it has been very organic, has been supported by a remarkably adaptive facilitation of our festival's complex needs. Hamish McRae, award-winning journalist and associate editor and principal economic commentator for the Independent newspaper in the UK, in his book, which I can recommend, What Works? Success in Stressful Times, The Secrets of the World's Best Organisations and Communities, begins his collection of 10 success stories with the story of Edinburgh's festivals. That's obviously why I can recommend it. And credits success to three things. Lesson one is the willingness to create and permit an open marketplace and accepting with the fringe, particularly, that what happens cannot be controlled. He sees the success of this approach as being enhanced not by massive financial investment, but by clearing bureaucratic barriers and easing the process of permits, licensing, building control, and health and safety for festivals that inhabit over 300 temporary spaces. As a former Fringe marketing manager, venue manager and director of a festival that takes place in 17 temporary spaces, I can vouch for the astonishing commitment, care and versatility of the City Council building control team in particular. But the act of transformation and the acceptance it requires is a broader one that needs the whole city to embrace the glorious disruption. Not everybody calls it glorious, but obviously I do in my role, that the Fringe particularly, but also its fellow festivals bring with them in August. And again, the City Council is amazing at ensuring that the potential chaos and uncertainty is managed. So what we're talking about in Edinburgh is managed uncertainty, managed, welcomed uncertainty actually as well, and kind of trusted uncertainty too. Hamish McRae's second lesson is the blend of top-down and bottom-up that characterised the birth of our festivals. He says there was no single-mind planning. There is still, actually, no single-mind plan. Not mine is, you know, I'm just influence, no power. No single-mind is planning what happens in Edinburgh. There are and always have been lots of minds which work in different ways. The trick which the various organisers of the festivals have managed to pull off is to achieve balance, to plan but not to overplan. to lead, but also to follow the demands of the market. And this leads to the third lesson, the need to listen, to be adaptive and experimental, to welcome the rebellious energy of those first fringe performers, to embrace new festivals that have been established with all the energy and the combined energy of cohabiting art forms, and of course, to allow the risk of experimentation and in turn of potential failure. It's an interesting recipe, a very different leadership recipe from the one in Dundee, their classic kind of create the vision, communicate it, marshal the resources, and one that we recognise and we refine. But there has been a growing recognition that Edinburgh's position as the world's leading festival city needs further collective action and collaboration. Another story commonly known as Thundering Hooves, and that's another story that we have had to tell and keep telling. And telling it was the equivalent of snatching those laurels from the heads of Edinburgh, from the head of Edinburgh. Snatching laurels from under Edinburgh and replacing them with the prickly discomfort of that thorn of crowns. I just keep saying that, crown of thorns. The Thundering Hooves report was a response to Edinburgh Festival's increasing concern about the lack of strategic investment into their needs and ambitions. It's metaphorically named after the competition catching up with Edinburgh. So, you know, and it was a massive study into Edinburgh's competitive position and an examination of its position vis-a-vis events all around the world. So Montreal, Barcelona, the Middle East, Singapore, and its cri de cœur was just that. Stop sitting on your laurels. Your position in the short term is unassailable, a sort of contradiction of terms in itself, but medium to long term, the investment being put into programming, venue infrastructure, marketing in other cities which were imitating Edinburgh's success, was a major risk to our preeminence. And the response to this report has been transformative again. The festivals came together in 2007 to form Festivals Edinburgh, so the organisation that I now lead. It was created by the directors. They are its board of directors, and they lead together with my support on their joint strategic development. It's grown for an initial collaboration at director and CEO level to a multi-layered and ambitious collaborative enterprise involving marketing, programming, innovation, environmental practice, and interest groups in fundraising and professional, all areas that define our competitive position. And also, Festivals Edinburgh has then led on an extended collaboration structure across the city and the development of a strategic infrastructure to ensure the ongoing success of the city. We have a Festivals Forum, which was created a few months after us, and it's made up of CEO level and senior politician level at representation across all our stakeholders and funders, the Scottish Government, the City Council, our creative agency, our events agency, our tourism agency, our regional development agency, our Chamber of Commerce, and the British Council, but also involving some key independent thinkers, chaired by a leading banker, and we need the independence in there to stop things from getting over-politicised. And their job is to literally make sure that Edinburgh remains the world's leading festival city, and that the investment strategies required to do that are in place. And since 2008, they and their officers have worked with Festivals Edinburgh to bring in an additional £7 million in programming investment, £1 million in marketing investment, into our innovation lab that we've created, £100,000 into the development of our role in cultural diplomacy, and £60,000 into our leadership role on environmental practice, which we're now evolving into a new company called Creative Carbon Scotland that will lead on the evolution and change behaviour in the cultural sector across Scotland. The level of increased investment is, I can't stress, I mean, I cried last year when they made the announcement because actually we're in an incredibly vulnerable position at the moment in Scotland. So it's something of a miracle in these challenging times. But to quote Sir Andrew Cooby, who is one of our Festival Forum members, these are times for boldness and direction and vision. And the Edinburgh Festivals, through their pioneering collaborative work and their focused strategic thinking, have these qualities in abundance. We need to think about what Scotland needs now and also about the kinds of organisations and enterprises that will create strong foundations for the future and enable the growth which will come after difficult times of austerity. The Edinburgh Festivals are an increasingly powerful cultural and economic force. We need to invest in them and capitalise on them now more than ever. He makes a good case, but a necessary case for boldness and vision. And he's telling another story for us, one which since earlier this year, like Dundee's, is based on a firm evidence base. In this case, the largest survey of its kind ever undertaken anywhere in the world. It's not the story of the glory of Edinburgh's festivals during that creative conflagration. It's not the story of the festivals as drivers of the change from decaying grandeur to international cosmopolitanism. And it's not the thundering hooves story of fending off competition. But it's a story refined to new times, to new circumstances and to new needs. Our third story is about our defining role in the future of our city and actually the future of our country, culturally, socially and economically. It's about our power as Scotland's world-leading cultural brand. 87% of journalists believe that Edinburgh's festival's high-quality programme outshine other cultural events. Our impacts on tourism and the economy. We have £261 million worth of economic impact for Scotland. That is more than the whole of the golf industry in Scotland. Of our roles as routes to new experiences, 93% of our audiences agree that the festivals had given them access to new work that they're not otherwise able to see, and to taking risks, 78% of our audiences said their experience in Edinburgh festivals encouraged them to see new work and art forms at other times. It's a story of our impact on civic pride and national confidence. 89% of our audiences said that the festivals increased their pride in Edinburgh as a city, and the same that they promoted an outward-looking, positive national identity. It's our ability to actually improve the quality of life of our citizens and community development. 65% of parents interviewed agreed that the festivals improved their children's well-being, and 62% said that the events that we created brought the whole community together. This is a story of where our National Economic Development Agency sees us as a leader and a pathfinder, not just in the cultural sector, but in the tourism sector and the creative industry sectors as well. So Edinburgh's festivals are economic powerhouses, they're cultural platforms, they're essential forums for national and international debate, they're drivers of ambition and creators of cohesion. That's our story. And of course, I'm here to tell you it in the hope that you will then tell it to others. But in Edinburgh, as in Dundee, we continue to be vulnerable to uncertainty. To the will and whim of politics, to the vagaries and crises of the economy, to global conflict and crisis, to the fickleness of the media, to the associated public opinion and confidence, we continue to be vulnerable to uncertainty, and yet also potentially inspired, as we were in 1947, by the opportunity that uncertainty throws up, and the ideas and approaches that we're freed up to throw at it, if we choose to. And in these times of extreme uncertainty, the most important story, the most powerful story, is the one that we tell to ourselves. So, Adelaide, what's your story? Thank you.
I think you're turbocharged, Faith. Fabulous. Well, we have now 10 minutes to ask questions, if you so wish. I will ask you, however, to go to the microphone at the back near that big black pole, but not to touch the big black pole, as it will wobble things. if anyone would like to ask questions, feel free, and I will start with some questions. In fact, I'll move to the microphone.
This is a bit strange, Christy.
It is, that's fine, but I think that these people know where to come should they have a question.
Yes, Christy.
There's significant economic problems in the UK, we understand. We still believe that we're somewhat buffered in Australia. I don't know how true that really is. However,
don't bank on it.
What has happened, particularly in real terms, in the 2011 Edinburgh Festival? Was it hard hit? Do you think it will have a significant effect in 2012 and onwards?
I was talking to someone about this the other night. When the banks went down, two of them were our banks that caused the problems. The first wave of panic was not about the... It was actually an intimate kind of panic, which was about our finances, because the banks sponsored us by huge amounts of money. So that was the first concern. And then we started going, oh my God, is this whole crisis going to affect people coming to our events? In fact, it hasn't. I mean, if you look at across the board, then some festivals have gone up, some have gone down very slightly, but you would, it'd be very hard to say that it was because of the economic crisis. It would be changes in programme, or I genuinely don't think that we've been negatively affected. If anything, in some cases, we may have been slightly positively affected. And my story is that in these times, what people are looking for is both meaning and distraction. And in combination and individually, that's what our festivals seem to provide. The kind of more kind of pragmatic explanation is also the value of the pound and the fact that the staycation market for us is enormous. So while we're getting visitors from countries where the exchange rate is positive, it's also in terms of people coming from the UK and particularly south of the border, that's the border with England, coming up to Edinburgh. So at the moment, we're doing pretty well. And again, we are not sitting on our laurels on that front. We've got the Olympics next year, which we see as both an opportunity and a threat. And we're working very hard on extension campaigns, getting people who are over to come up to Edinburgh, but also displacement campaigns saying London will be hideous, come here to us instead. And we're having to be, don't quote me on that, we have to keep working incredibly hard. And a lot of the work that we do collectively is about, you know, future gazing to see what we need to be thinking about next to make sure that, we're looking at those issues.
Another one then for me, please, if you'll indulge me. I understand that Dundee Contemporary Arts is a year-round facilitation for, you know, activity. Is there an enormous lethargy in Edinburgh after the festival season with the normal year-round cultural events? And, you know, particularly the theatre companies and other, you know, artists trying to get audiences, do you think because Edinburgh Festival's been happening so long, there's now a new psyche, or is there a strong and healthy year-round culture?
Well, part of the reason there's a strong and healthy year-round culture, and to be honest, the kind of quality and diversity and texture of the work that happens in Scotland is because our artists get access to work from all over the world, but they also get this massive kind of experimental space in which they can test their work out as well. And till recently, they had to take all their own risks at the fringe. So there was absolutely no funding for a Scottish company performing at the fringe, even though there was funding for English companies and companies from all over the world. We've changed that, and there's now investment into Scottish work, which matters. All of the spaces and almost all of the companies in Scotland are used as and it's part of their kind of income. The companies, almost all of them, the large ones now, even the Lyceum Theatre, our National Theatre of Scotland, performs at both the International Festival and the Fringe. They use them. They use the festival as a kind of platform and as a place to then take work out into the world. So they're given opportunities in a way that, you know, other companies in other countries and cities wouldn't have the opportunity to do so. There's always, because there's such a focus on us, media-wise as well, I think that's sometimes problematic. And people do say, oh, you can sleep in September, you know. And there is a moment where we all catch our breath because it's huge. And the city just needs to catch its breath as well. But again, that thing that I said about risk, we're actually encouraging people to kind of expand their perspectives and see more work and more art forms. But undoubtedly, if you look at the pattern of people buying tickets in the city, then they will buy more tickets and spend more money. The two times are the festival, when they, you know, go in and spend money and engage, and then the Christmas show. And those are the kind of peaks, and people tend to have a kind of more spread out pattern for the rest of the year.
Thank you. That was a terrific talk. I really enjoyed what you had to say. And I just wanted to pick up on a very small thing that you said when you were talking about Dundee. You used the phrase, more or less, leadership from universities. Now, as someone who actually works at a university and teaches at one, I was rather gobsmacked to hear that term, leadership from universities, into the community. I was wondering if you could expand on what that consisted of.
I mean, there's a broad, that thing I talked about, an aspirational curve, there's a broad sense in all the universities in the city that they have a commitment from, you know, almost primary school onwards to see how a person from birth through to, you know, employment and the development of their careers within that employment might move in the city. So looking at it from that perspective, all the kind of different bodies in the city are thinking about that. And so that's an interesting, it's because it's a small city and because I suppose that thinking was embedded I mean, partly through DCA, actually. It was definitely a means of kind of soldering that together. There's a number of universities. There's Dundee University, but there's Abertay University, which specializes in games design and animation. There's also a very strong department in that area at the Art College that's now part of the university as well. And again, we had the Visual Research Center for the University of Dundee in our space. They sat on our board and still do, and really were the ones that took that idea of it being a modest thing into something that would really be defining. They see it as part of their brand, an extended part of their brand, and the city does obviously as well. But DCA is something that they're probably as proud of, if not more proud of, than their big research centres. So yeah, they were defining. There's an interesting project going on in Edinburgh at the moment that I'm part of, which is defining Edinburgh, and I think it's again relevant in Adelaide for as a city of learning. And again, I'm watching that evolved thinking and partnership thinking that we have definitely contributed to. So working very closely, we work very closely with the University of Edinburgh on evolving this idea as well and the other universities in the city. But there's something also, and I've been speaking about this about Adelaide, about identifying where your strengths are and then connecting them together. So another great strength in Edinburgh is the informatics department. It's one of the leading centre for computer engineering in the country. And you think, what the hell's that got to do with the festivals? But we're going, one, well, there's another great world-defining brand in the city, a leader, and we should be at least promoting each other, but it goes much, much deeper than that. We're now engaged in detailed research on how we redefine the way the tourism industry works through digital media. So it's about individual leadership in particular fields and then seeing how that can be evolved into combined cultural leadership through partnership. Partnership really matters.
Well, I think any other questions? I shall wrap it up from the back of the room. Thank you so much, Faith, and thanks everyone for coming.
Thank you.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.